RadioInfluence.com.
This is Landry Football on Radio Influence, the only podcast where you can get perspective of what happened on the gridiron through the eyes of a coach, scout, and front office administrator. Now, it's time to step into the film room. Here's Chris Landry.
And welcome into the Thursday, January 4th edition of the Landry Football Podcast, where we are heading into a big weekend of football, obviously wild card weekend, and ending it up on Monday night with the national championship game. We're going to get into that. We're going to talk a little bit about the Rooney Rule as we've got NFL coaching searches and hires coming up. Touch on a few things. I want to remind you that if you have not checked out our website, LandryFootball.com, please do. We think you will love it. It's got we take you inside the film room, the college and pro game. We give you the inside information and the news and notes going on around the college and pro game. And we're transitioning, obviously, as the games are slowly winding down. We certainly got some big games left in the NFL and a big one in college football, of course. But we don't take off. During the off season, there is no off season. It just transitions into the business season, recruiting, free agency, the draft, you name it. We cover it at LandryFootball.com. So a few things going on. Want to get into something that I think is important to discuss right off the top. And it is the Rooney Rule that has been put into place a few years ago. And being involved with the process, and certainly the spirit of the rule was put into play to give minority candidates an opportunity to get some exposure, to interact with owners. And just a little bit of a background on how the football business works on the inside. And it's probably not unlike any other business in which, you know, people call it the old boys network. And that's fine. That's a tag that is probably deserved, but it's also just a common sense. You know who you know, you associate who you associate with, and you become familiar with people and comfortable with people, and that's who you tend to turn to in any line of business. And it's certainly the case in the coaching business. It's certainly the case when you are a general manager, an athletic director, an owner, any of those people, you become a little bit closer and a little bit more fond of this guy or that guy. You just know them as opposed to somebody you don't know. And that's understandable. It's human nature, and there's nothing wrong with it. However, I think that over the years, those of us that have been in the business realize that it's important to think outside the box, to get to know more people. And at least in football, my perspective, I've always used in my coaching search work a similar formula and a similar grading scale in evaluating players. I mean, it's a different critical factors, but you grade them. You watch your teams play, and that's the greatest resume right there. How does that team play? Who does what inside the organization? Who's responsible for what? You can sit there, and a lot of times people make mistakes because they affix credit or blame to someone inside an organization where it's a little bit exaggerated one way or the other. And so sometimes you don't get a real feel for who's doing what and who's really responsible for what. But you still have a better feel for it in terms of being able to study the game. And I do think people that have a background in coaching and scouting have a better feel for other coaches and scouts. It's just human nature. Now, and you work with people regularly, you get to know them. Well, the problem is, for years, I think a lot of people that it's like breaking the ceiling, and had a lot of good African-American coaches and potential guys that never got opportunities. And we've heard the stories in the past of, well, they can get position jobs but not coordinator jobs. And then you get coordinator jobs, you can't get head jobs. And get maybe, you know, low-rung scouting jobs, but they can't become personnel directors. They can be personnel directors, but they can't be GMs, and yada, yada, yada. Well, it's not that they can't. It's just that, you know, the comfort level of knowing the guy well enough is not there. So you're more inclined to go with candidate A than B if you know A better. So the rule, the spirit of the rule was to put into play to give guys an opportunity to interview with decision makers so that they can get their name out there, they can get exposure to people that are hiring. Because let me just tell you this, while it is a competitive business, trust me, I live in it every day. When a guy has a good interview at a place, college football, but definitely in the NFL, you hear about it around the league. Boy, so-and-so had a great interview. Now, he may not get the job. Only one person can get the job. But you hear about it, and it usually leads to a little bit of scuttlebutt about, hey, this guy's, boy, he interviewed with Detroit. He interviewed with Atlanta. Boy, I tell you, you know, he might be another guy. That's all part of the cycle of this business. So that's the reason for the Rooney Rule, is to give guys that are deserving exposure. Now, some people will say they think that the spirit of the Rooney Rule is that they legitimately get a shot at a job. Well, first of all, if somebody has somebody that they want for the job, you can't begrudge them whether you agree or disagree with the move and think it will or will not be successful. You can't begrudge them for saying, I want, you know, John Doe there. That's the guy that I wanted. I've always wanted him to be my head coach, my GM, my whatever, and that's who I'm going to hire. You can't blame them for that. Okay? People think it's a sham if a minority goes and interviews for that job. Well, no, I don't agree with that. And let me tell you why. It might be fine if you think that. It's a sham if you think that the only purpose is for that candidate to interview for that job and maybe have a realistic shot at that job. Sometimes it's not realistic. Sometimes the job is wide open and they don't know who they're going to hire, and you wow them and you get it. But sometimes it's clear who they want. That's okay. Again, that's fine. It's okay to go ahead and interview for a job. Two things. When you hire as somebody doing the interviewing, your dream hire may not work. In 2 or 3 years, you might be looking again. Guess what? You'll remember that interview that you had with that other guy and others that you talk with, and it may resonate. For the candidate, it's great experience. Learning how to interview is just like learning any other discipline. When you become a coordinator, you got to call plays. You got to run meetings. Well, when you're interviewing, it's a different process that's important to get experience with. In fact, not only is it important, it's, I think, necessary. I have myself done mock interviews with people. I've had people have me interview them before they go on an interview because it just helps them get a feel for the questions they're going to get and develop a comfort level. Kind of know what some out-of-the-box questions might be just to be prepared. It's again, an understanding of the process. I have a problem when people in the media or just fans, talk show hosts, what have you, feel like, oh, it's a sham. You've never been a part of the business. How could you know what's a sham or not? I mean, stick to what happens in the media world or in your sales world or whatever business you're in. Don't dictate to people inside the business what's real or what's a sham. The increase in quality African American coaches as head coaches, coordinators, has increased largely due to this, because they've had interviews. I mean, you got to understand that when you interview, it just makes a difference, even if that job is going somewhere else. Even if you interview and what's the difference between it's not a chance versus you go put your best foot forward and it may mean a job somewhere else. It's important to understand that. People who are in the business understand it. Now, let me say this. Some will say, I don't want to take away an interview from someone else. Meaning, all you have to do is interview one minority, and you meet the criteria for the Rooney Rule. Well, some don't want to interview because maybe they've interviewed before, and they feel like, well, wait a minute, that interview should go to someone else. Well, that's fine. If you have no interest in interviewing for the job and you have no interest in being in that type of position in the future, fine. Tell them that. And, you know, hey, if I may, I'd really highly recommend so-and-so. I've worked with him. This is what I know about him. He'd be a great fit. I think so-and-so and so-and-so in your organization knows him well. You may or may not have talked about him, but I certainly would think he would do a job that is every bit as good, if not better, than I would. I mean, I think those things are fine. But in terms of criticizing someone for interviewing for a job where they may not get it, and it goes to the Raiders situation, it's pretty clear that John Gruden wants the job and Mark Davis wants him for the job. And so if that's going to be a marriage and it's going to work out and they're happy with it, that's fine. Whether I or anyone else thinks it's a good move is immaterial. If that's who they want to hire, that's who they will hire. But don't begrudge someone who may want to go on an interview and sharpen his skills. Maybe he ends up being the Raider coach the next time around, or the Chiefs coach, or, you know, the Jets coach. I mean, who knows? It's important. So keep that in mind. Rooney Rule is not about, hey, look, you need to assure me that there's a chance that I can get this job. I can't assure you of anything. I can give you an interview. I can grant you an interview. Go in there and impress them. And you know what? There are a lot of stories. Jack Del Rio went into Jacksonville as a courtesy interview. Courtesy interview. Got the job. Bill Cowher got a courtesy interview with the Cleveland Browns because he was a former Brown special teams player and special teams coach under Marty Schottenheimer. Had a great interview, but they hired Bill Belichick. The interview went so well with Cowher that the word got around, and it got around to the Steelers, and the Steelers interviewed him, and the rest is history. It's just, you don't know where it'll lead. You hear this a lot in your own life. Just keep working. Keep your nose to the grindstone. Do the right things, and things will perhaps come your way. It sounds a little Pollyanna, I know, but in the coaching world, you do the right things, you work, you get look at the opportunity as any other chance to kind of express yourself to the people that are going to be doing the hiring in the league. It makes a world of difference. It's great. And by the way, it can also help you where you're currently at. In interviewing as many candidates as possible is a great thing for an organization. The reason is you get an outside eyes views on your organization. What do you like about our team? What do you don't like about our team? Those things are very, very valuable and could help you and your staff improve the outlook of your team. Want to address something else, a couple of other things on in the college football end, and it has certainly been something I didn't address, neglected to address on Tuesday's show, and it was the performance by some bowl teams. And I specifically want to talk about Michigan and Auburn. Michigan first, the 19-3 lead blown against South Carolina was most disappointing. And where does this put Jim Harbaugh? Well, I think with Jim Harbaugh, there probably couldn't have been a more of a slam dunk hire. When you talk about guys that were proven as a coach at Stanford, took a team to a Super Bowl in San Francisco, and he goes to his alma mater, was there a more perfect scenario? It just hasn't worked anywhere near what most of us thought. You know, when you struggle against your rivals, it's a problem. And when you have issues where you blow a bowl game like that, it only adds to it. It only adds to the negativity. He's recruited fairly well. He's gotten some really good players. Not enough of them. Hasn't fixed the quarterback position, something he's very good at, something that's going to have to be fixed. You look at it, in the last two Novembers, he's like 4-6 in November. At the time where well-coached teams get better, his teams are not getting better. 4-6. And all four of those losses, he blew leads in the fourth quarter. It's certainly a time where he's got to examine a lot of things in his program, not panic, not overreact, but figure out where he needs to improve from stem to stern, because next year is going to be a year in which, if they continue to get beaten by Michigan State, get beaten by Ohio State, you know, not be strong contenders in the Big Ten East, it's going to start to get uncomfortable, really uncomfortable. And where do you go if you're Michigan? If Jim Harbaugh can't fix it, wow. It's not something that is just gripping every nook and cranny of Ann Arbor, but it is something that I think nationally is starting to get a lot of play, and we'll see how it plays out. Auburn, disappointing performance against Central Florida. Did not play very well. Looked like, you know, a lot of guys were going through the motions. And I wanted to bring them up because for two reasons. I want to talk a little bit on Central Florida and their issues, or their argument that they are putting forth. But it is one of the, what I call the dangers of leverage. Now, I think Gus Malzahn has been a good coach. I think he's done a very good job. But for the folks on the outside that don't really understand what the Auburn fan goes through, is the inconsistencies with Gus Malzahn is enough to pull your hair out. And it's kind of the same old Gus. Yeah, he'll pull the upset against Alabama. Oh, yeah, he'll beat a Georgia, and he'll come back, and he'll, you know, may lose. You're not going to win every game. This is a good Auburn team. You know, should not have lost to LSU, should not have lost this bowl game. Maybe would have been in a different bowl game had they not lost to LSU. I think the Alabama game and the Georgia game were, the FCC championship game and the regular season game were the two games that, or excuse me, the three games that were potentially in peril, and Clemson at the beginning of the year. So you play Clemson, you got Georgia, and you got Alabama. You know, those are three games that, to me, that were, you know, potentially you could make the case. Well, they beat Georgia, and they beat Alabama, they lose to Clemson, then they lose the conference championship game, but they also blew the LSU game. And what I'm saying is would you look at the history of Gus as the inconsistencies? You know, it's, does he have the championship pedigree to finish and stay on top of the details? You know, and I think it's going to be frustrating, because now that Auburn has completely married him, and boy, have they married him with a lot of money. It's, listen, I know that Auburn can walk away and pay a lot of money, but they are not paying money for a while. He's going to be there for a while. And I think there's a sense of frustration that, and rightly so, that, look, this is going to be what it is. It's going to be up. It's going to be down. And there's no consistency. And they look at Georgia. Their two biggest rivals are Georgia and Alabama. And those programs have consistency. We know that Alabama's on a different level. But Georgia with Kirby, and I know Kirby lost to Auburn, but he came back and fixed it and won it, and he's in the national championship game. Auburn, we've seen Auburn get to the championship game too. But we see them dip. Now, and we don't know about the long-range cycle of Kirby. We don't know, for example, that he might not be inconsistent. Time will tell. But I do think that is enough of a sample size to wonder if this might not be a tough stretch. Where there is certainly a lot of security for Gus Malzahn, but you don't see that there's seen feel that there's anything different about the program. Central Florida. Great season, good team, good coaching staff, good head coach, really good program, large enrollment, really good team. I think that what they're doing with trying to, quote-unquote, anoint themselves a national champion is a good marketing ploy as they try to maybe get front page and create an image that maybe be something that somebody will consider to bring in to a Power 5 conference. But make no mistake, that's the very reason why it's ridiculous to seriously consider them as a national champion. I get it that in the past you had anointed champions, and there's some of them were ridiculous back in the day, but the reality is you're still talking about the best teams in college football playing, you know, requisite schedules and making a comparison. This is not even a discussion. The AAC is not part of the Power Six, like Danny White says. There is no Power Six. That doesn't exist. It's a Power Five. The AAC is a good league. It's now the best of the group of five, but they are a group of five. They're not an elite program. They didn't win a game a couple of years ago. They went unbeaten. We don't know how they're going to sustain the program. All those things are to be determined. What is already been determined is, yes, they're good. And, yes, on a given day, they can win a game. Houston, on a given day, beat Oklahoma last year in the early part of the season. But winning on a given game, on a given Saturday, in the fall, does not equate to going through the gauntlet of a schedule of the ACC, the SEC, the Big Ten, the Big 12, the Pac-12. That's a completely different dynamic, folks. And, you know, while it is speculative to say they would have a whatever record if they were in one of those conferences, also very speculative to assume that they would beat somebody else and, you know, end up with a similar record in one of those conferences. In fact, it's a false assumption because the reality is they're not at a different level. Now, let me explain the difference between playing in a Power 5 versus a Group of 5 schedule. What you're playing is teams that are decent to average to way below. So you've got a lot of games in which you can manage pretty easily win because the teams are not very good. When you look at the AAC, South Florida's not bad. Memphis is not bad. It's got some good teams, just not a lot of really good teams, not teams that would test you on a week-in, week-out basis. The difference between Group of Five schools and Power Five schools is the bottom 40 of the roster. The top 40, some Group of Fives can compare to some Power Fives. There's no doubt. But the bottom 40 is a big difference. So the attrition that doesn't get tested in the Group of Five schedule gets really tested in the Power Five schedule. So, you know, it's not that you can't beat Auburn in a bowl game. Of course you can beat Auburn. Central Florida under George O'Leary beat Baylor a couple of years ago. They can do it. They've done it. Boise's done it against Oklahoma. It can be done. It has been done. It'll be done again. But that doesn't equate, folks, to playing week in, week out against tougher opponents. The cumulative effect of playing in those games, it's what makes the difference. And that's what I don't think people understand. So keep that in mind. Now, as we move on to the national championship game, we want to pick up where we left off. Well, want to get one more thing before we get into the championship game. We wanted to touch base on news that came out last night that LSU defensive coordinator Dave Aranda has re-signed with the Tigers on a four-year deal, $2.5 million a year, $10 million guaranteed. Now, what does that mean for LSU? Well, it was a must for LSU. as he was being courted by Texas A&M. I mentioned on Tuesday that he certainly was a candidate at Green Bay with the Packers, and it was something that he had interest in. But they were thinking more along the lines of NFL coordinator jobs. What does this really mean? Well, it means what we've said all along in our podcast back in October and our reporting that, listen, when they made this hire with Ed Orgeron, they were basically saying we need to prop him up with coordinators because he's not the strength of this program. Well, the strength certainly of the coordinators is Aranda, as we know that the Matt Canada situation has fallen apart. To lose Dave Aranda would have been devastating for LSU. It does not mean that Dave Aranda is going to be here 4 years. It's not. I can tell you that he won't serve 4 years as LSU's defensive coordinator. He's going to move on before that, maybe potentially move up at LSU, depending on how things go. That is to be determined, but he won't be there 4 years. But it was, again, a case where Texas A&M was interested in him. Obviously not interested enough to put the price tag up to 275 or 28. But they were interested. LSU wasn't interested. They were desperate. They had to have it. And if you look at the gap between what the head coach is making and the defensive coordinator is making, it tells you all you need to know about what they think of the head coach. And it gives you an indication, too, with the power structure, or lack thereof, of how the head coach is respected or not respected amongst the staff. It's, you know, what's the old saying, he fit the suit? Ed signs the part, looks the part. But I can tell you, inside that coaching staff, they don't really look to him for leadership and guidance. They kind of know that they got to handle their own stuff. It's a completely different dynamic. It is definitely a case where the coordinators run the show. The coordinators make the decisions. The coordinators are more important than the head coach. No doubt. National championship game. I think in terms of how Georgia's going to prepare for this is very much going to be off the game plan of the conference championship game against Auburn. I think they're going to try to attack the edges against Alabama. I think they're going to try to get the running backs in space. They're going to get the ball out of the hands of Fromm as quickly as they can. They don't want to sit back with a pocket passer and have Alabama pressure him, play two deep man under and take the passing game away and to run game with seven. They can't do that. Georgia has to find a way to get the ball out in space and try to attack Alabama's speed if they can. Try to get the backs in one-on-one situations, make a guy miss, keep the drives going. Unlike Alabama, they don't have a quarterback in Fromm that can move, so they're going to have to use him as a distributor of the football. But they've got great backs that can play with anyone. So we'll see how that plays out and how they're able to formulate that game plan to sustain drives. Defensively for Georgia, the key is they've got to find a way stop the run, even if they got to play it with numbers, stop the run, and they've got to defend Jalen Hurts as a runner. Very curious to see how they play coverage-wise. Did not play zone very well early. Moved to man, was outstanding. Took a lot of chances against Oklahoma. They'll do that again if they have to. Adjustments are definitely a Kirby Smart strength. They would definitely try to take away the run, force Alabama to beat him with the pass. And Alabama is going to offensively try to have a lot of design runs for Jalen Hurts. That's going to be a big part of what they try to do. They're going to try to get on the edges with him. Unlike Georgia, who's going to try to throw the football on the perimeter, I think Alabama will try to do some of it. But I think they're going to be a run focused attack with the quarterback. Again, can they run the football on Georgia? And defensively for Alabama, can they defend the run with seven? That's going to be a key. Folks, the key to this game, you will look at it. The key is going to be what defense can defend the opposing team's running game with seven and keep their safeties deep against the pass. You can defend the run with seven, you've got a really good shot. Bring some pressure from time to time. Pressure probably more from Alabama than Georgia, but Georgia by nature likes the pressure. But how much pressure against a quarterback that they're going to design to run, it's going to be interesting to see. It'll be a pivotal part of the game. Can any of his pupils beat Nick Saban? Well, no one's done it before, but this is a little different. Kirby Smart knows Nick Saban better than any of his assistants. He won't be surprised with anything that they're doing. He knows their personnel. He knows how they use it. He knows what they want to do. He's trying to do it himself. Going to be really pivotal. Going to really be, to me, I think, the toughest of the matchups that he's had against his proteges, because I think it's the best team. Most of the teams, Derek Dooley, Jim McElwain, Mark D'Antonio, not had really good teams going up against Nick. So those things to keep in mind. Folks, it is a toss-up game. More than any, I think it is a toss-up game than even the semifinal games of this past weekend. I would give Alabama the edge because of Nick Saban's experience, but I think it's a toss-up game, and I think Georgia certainly has a good shot. Give me Alabama in a close one. NFL playoffs this week. And remind you that we will give you updates on Twitter at Landry Football, as well as in our NFL notebooks on the latest on the coaching searches around the NFL. Want to spend a little time on the matchups in the NFL this week. We open up with Tennessee at Kansas City. In Kansas City, you know, this is a game, when I look at it, Tennessee's not been able to run the football as well as they need to. They've got to run it well. Kansas City's been vulnerable defending the run near the bottom of the league. If they can get the running game going and get Marcus Mariota involved, it can make for some play-action opportunities. Now, Kansas City works that offense, like to be a high-powered offense. You know, for Kansas City, they've got to get off to a quick start, force Mariota to beat him from the pocket. He's not as good in the pocket as he is outside of the pocket. Watch the matchup, Travis Kelce against the Titans safety, Kevin Byard. He's the ball hawking safety. He'll get to check Kelce a lot. Watch and see how well Jack Conklin will do up against Justin Houston. What a really good matchup that's going to be. Tyreek Hill against Adoree Jackson, Chiefs receiver against the Titans corner, all keys. How will Mariota play? Can he run the football? Can the Titans find a way to run it? They can't. They've got no shot in this game. They really got no shot. Kansas City is a must-win. If they were to lose this game with their playoff history, it just would be a tough, tough offseason for them. Kansas City is the best team here. It's the first time Tennessee's been in the playoffs for some time. They're just better at the skill positions in Tennessee. They've got Alex Smith. I trust them a lot more than I do Tennessee. For the complete film room breakdown of both Tennessee and Kansas City, as well as the film room game breakdown, check it out at LandryFootball.com. Atlanta goes out west to play the Rams. Atlanta Falcons, Super Bowl participants last year. People thought it was only a matter of time before they figured it out, get back on track, make a run at it. Well, here's their time. Time's running out. We've been waiting for them to kind of figure it out all year long, but they've just not been able to do it. There have been times where they've played better than others, but they just haven't been that successful. Falcons average a little under 116 yards rushing per game. They got to run the football. If you're going to slow down the pass rush of the Rams, you got to run the football on them. You can run the football on the Rams. That's not their strength. They get upfield, rush the passer. They're a one-gap front. You can run the football on them. They've got to be able to do that. Conversely, what the Rams want to do is pressure Matt Ryan. Get him into difficult down-and-distance situations. The Falcons are going to be without guard Andrew Levitre, who's got a tricep injury. That's going to be an issue. Want to see what Tremaine Johnson does against Julio Jones, how they defend Julio. But, again, it's going to be about pressure up front. Jake Matthews, good luck against Aaron Donald. You're going to need to give him some help, as you do everyone. And then I want to see Devontae Freeman and what the Falcons could do offensively. We'll see what Steve Sarkisian will do, trying to use him to attack Alex Ogletree. I just look at this game and think Rams are a better team. They've played better all year long. They've got maybe the MVP in the league in Todd Gurley. I think they're going to be able to run the football. I think they've got playmakers. I like their play design a little better. I like their tempo a little better. Atlanta is very capable of winning this game. If you're looking for a team that goes on a road and win it, this is probably the team that's most capable of doing it. Most capable, but hasn't shown it all year. So buyer beware on this. But I do like the Rams at home. And it's usually a road team that wins it. And this is maybe the most likely we'll see. But I still think the Rams are the better team going into the game. Sunday we got Buffalo and Jacksonville. Buffalo's so excited to get back into the playoffs. You know, the last time the Bills were in the playoffs, the last game they played in the playoffs, I was on the sideline for it. It was the Music City Miracle game in Tennessee against us, and on our run to the Super Bowl, they lost a very controversial, close-type game that they, quite frankly, outplayed us. They're excited to be in, but they, want to perform well and are playing a Jacksonville team that's not playing well going into it. The running game, it's going to be interesting to see what they can get, if anything, out of LeSean McCoy. He just doesn't look like he's not going to be able to play at all. So it's going to be Mike Tolbert and Marcus Murphy, and it's going to be tough against a stout defensive front. The statistical measurements of the Jacksonville defense has not been all that good, but they still are very stout. They still play with good leverage, and I think that it's going to be very difficult for them to have a lot of success against this Jacksonville defense. They don't throw the football very well, and you take the best player off their offense as a runner, and you got some problems, I think, if you're Buffalo. Jacksonville, what can they get done offensively? Buffalo's got to stop Fournette. They got to make Bortles win the game. Couple key matchups, when Buffalo has the ball, can Kelvin Benjamin do something against A.J. Boye and Jalen Ramsey? Good players there. Jacksonville, their running game, we'll see what Preston Brown and company can do against those guys. Then what Charles Clay can do against Jags safety, Deshaun Gibson. Those are kind of some spotlights, but Marcell Dareus is going to be a big part of it. I just look and see that Jacksonville should be able to use enough balance on offense to keep the Bills on their heels, make Tyrod Taylor play from behind. I just think Jacksonville wins and wins going away. Carolina, New Orleans. Another case of two teams going into the playoffs, not on a high note, not playing their best ball. So what gives? Saints have got to run the football better than they did the last couple of weeks. That's going to be imperative. That's what fuels their offense. That's what allows mismatches in the passing game, and that's what allows their defense to stay fresh on the field. It's going to have to happen again for them to be successful. Carolina is going to have to get off to a good start. If they get behind, this is not a team that can be a quick-scoring, quick-strike offense. They're a methodical passing offense that's built on the line of scrimmage, but they're very capable of playing well at the line of scrimmage and winning here. They've got to run the football well. That is the key element to make their offense go. Saints struggled against, you know, Jameis Winston for stretches, but they also forced some negative plays. I thought the key for the Saints last week in their loss to Tampa was just their inability to sustain enough offense in the running game. That was the big factor. So we'll see how it goes. Give me the Saints in a close one at home. Get their offense on track. The experience of Drew Brees, I think, is enough to get it done. So, liking all the home teams, and you know one of those home teams are going to lose, so take it as you will. And a reminder that if Kansas City were to win, they get the better matchup for them in New England. They match up better with New England than Pittsburgh. And the Saints, if they win, they get, I think, the preferred matchup by going to Philadelphia, provided the Rams beat Atlanta. Because if Atlanta wins, then Atlanta goes and gets Philadelphia, and the Vikings would host the Saints. So we'll see how it shapes up. We'll see how it breaks down. And we'll have it all broken down for you here on the Tuesday edition of the Landry Football Podcast. Remind you to check out the website, LandryFootball.com. We'll break, again, all of these games down, tell you what we see, tell you what we find inside the film room, as well as provide all the latest news and notes going on around the college and NFL scene. So check it, and we'll certainly get you ready for the national championship game. So check it out, and we appreciate you joining us. Have a great weekend of football, folks, and join us on the Tuesday edition of the Landry Football Podcast on the LandryFootball.com.
To get more of Chris's knowledge, visit and subscribe to LandryFootball.com. You can also find him on Twitter at LandryFootball. This has been Landry Football on Radio Influence.
Here is Kevin Kennedy and Rich Herrera with an Inside the Dugout Quick Fix.
Let me run through all of this for you. So we talk about luxury tax. It's not really called luxury tax. Its actual name is the competitive balance tax.
Right.
And this is from MLB.com. Those who carry payrolls above the threshold are taxed on each dollar above the threshold, and the tax rate increasing based on the number of consecutive years a club has exceeded that threshold. The threshold was $189 million at 14, 15, and 16. But the following increases were put together in this next collective bargaining agreement. So 2017, the luxury tax was $195 million. 2018, it's $197. 2019, it's $206, and so on and so forth. The reason I bring this up is there's a penalty that goes along with this as well. So if you're over the competitive balance tax, the luxury tax,
For simple terms, we call it the luxury tax.
So the first time you're over the luxury tax, right, you get taxed 20% on all the overages. So if you spent more than $195 million, every dollar that you spend, you pay a 20 cents tax back to the rest of baseball.
Right. You're paying $1.20 is what you're paying.
Okay. So when you exceed that threshold for the second consecutive year, that figure goes up to 30%. Three or more straight seasons of exceeding that threshold comes to a 50% luxury tax. Now, here's the important thing for Dodger fans and Yankee fans as well.
Yep, that's right.
If you dip below that tax, you reset the clock. So if I'm above 1 year, I pay 20. I'm above 2 years, I pay 30. If I continue, I'm above 50, and I get to that 50 point, all I got to do is get below the threshold once, and I reset the tax back to 20%. Clubs that exceed that threshold by $20 million to $40 million are also subject to a 12% surtax. Meanwhile, those who exceed it by more than $40 million are taxed at 42.5% rate of the first 45% they exceed more than $40 million. In the beginning of 2018, clubs that were $40 million or more above the threshold shall have their highest selection in the Rule 4 draft move back 10 places unless the pick falls into the top six. So if you're way above this luxury tax, the way the Dodgers have been 5 straight years, Yankees have been 15 straight years, you got to get right under the CBA.
Inside the Dugout with Kevin Kennedy and Rich Herrera can be found on iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, and RadioInfluence.com.